out of Philly, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Lucerne. I recently had a debate with the one and only Gavin Ortlund, that perfect gentleman, the theologian and pastor. We had a debate on divine simplicity, but there are many issues left to discuss. So today I sit down with Dr. Andrew Hollingsworth and Dr. Chad McIntosh to discuss divine simplicity, metaphysical dependency, the Trinity, and so much more. If you'd like to support the show, you can donate money to my Patreon account or my Ko-fi account. Any donation amount helps me out in so many ways. I greatly appreciate all the support that people have already offered. If you have questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here we are chatting about simplicity. Enjoy. So let's get started today. So I've got here with me two top-notch philosophical theologians. I've got Andrew Hollingsworth and Chad McIntosh. I've not had them on the show in a while. They've both been on in the past. So why don't each of you just say your name, say hello, let the audience get you familiar to the sound of your voices.
I'm Andrew Hollingsworth. I'm an affiliate professor with Kairos University and also a lead planter for Church of the Holy Trinity here in Mandeville, Louisiana.
I'm Chad McIntosh. I am a no-name podunk wannabe philosopher living in Central Ohio, a PhD from Cornell University. I've been sitting on my hands ever since.
I can affirm all of that about Chad.
All right, so today what we're going to be doing is we're going to review this debate I just had with Gavin Ortlund. So I was on Idol Killer debating the doctrine of divine simplicity. And before we get into that, I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on the format, because it was a bit different. So in case anyone didn't watch this, so what we did was we had to record the opening statements in advance, and then we released them a week before the live debate, so that way people could watch the opening statements, kind of start figuring out what questions they want to ask during the live debate. And then during the live chat, Gavin and I had to steel man each other's views, and that was followed by a 30-minute back and forth, and then we ended with like a 30-minute Q&A from the audience. So what did you guys think of the format, and then what was your just kind of initial impressions of the debate overall?
Yeah, I really liked it, honestly. I liked how it gave the audience some time to reflect on each of you, the participants' positions, to think about your arguments against the divine simplicity, to think about Gavin's arguments in favor of it, and why he thinks it's so important. I really liked the idea of steel manning each other's positions. It gives you each a chance to not really strawman or caricature each other's views, which I thought was a great practice, and I think it's a good something to teach people in the world of internet fighting, internet debating. So I thought it was really good, and I'd honestly kind of like to see more YouTube debates do something kind of similar to that. I think it's a good practice in charity and so forth.
Yeah, I thought the format was fantastic. I thought it was very clever. It has the potential to be a much more productive and congenial way of organizing these kinds of discussions. As for the debate itself, it seemed to me like the philosophical red meat wasn't really bitten into. Way too much time on appetizers, like whether we're interpreting so-and-so accurately. And I mean, that's important stuff, especially in more formal contexts, but probably wasn't what most viewers were tuning in to see. I mean, they want to be entertained, as it was said in the debate. So I think the question, for example, I mean, the question of what simplicity is wasn't even discussed until about 15 minutes into the debate, which I think is unfortunate.
Yeah, because I mean, I really like the format. And then based on Gavin's publications, I really thought we were going to agree on the meaning of divine simplicity based on what he's written in the past. Mm. So I was really surprised by his opening statement and that we had to, but we'll get into that like later. But Andrew, you've got some questions you want to ask.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Ryan. So you've been doing these YouTube debates, these podcasts, and stuff like this for a good while now, and you always seem like you've put a lot of work into your preparation and stuff. So I'm just curious, And I want to say the same for Gavin. He also looks like he puts a lot of preparation and work into his stuff. But I wanted to ask you, so just curious, how is it that you go about preparing for these dialogues and debates like this? Is it something you just do like the day before? Because it doesn't seem like that. It seems like you put a good bit of work into it. So just curious what that looks like.
So to start, I have three main criteria that I look for in a potential debate partner. Do they know what they're talking about? Can they follow an argument? And can they disagree well? Because I'm not interested in talking to like intellectually dishonest people that just make stuff up. Because I get a lot of those gaslighting people ask me to debate, and I'm just like, no, like I'm not interested in that. And then next, after I find someone we want to debate, we agree on like the topics and the arguments we want to cover. We agree on definitions in advance. And typically what I do is I write out all of my arguments in advance, and then I give it to my debate partner so that way they know exactly what I'm going to say. Like there's no surprises. And then my hope is my debate partner is going to, since they have everything in advance, they're going to come up with something substantive to say, because the goal is to give the audience like two clear, well thought out perspectives. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't, because sometimes my partners don't read the things I sent them, so they don't come prepared. And this debate was a little bit different because the format, since we were pre-recording our opening statements. So what we did is we agreed on the topics. I thought we agreed on the definitions based on a paper of his from the International Journal of Systematic Theology. But I gave Gavin a forthcoming paper of mine, and I also sent him two podcast episodes I've done. So that's how I prepared for this particular debate.
Yeah, I got a question too, Ryan, if you don't mind. And that's that toward the beginning of the discussion, you asked Gavin about his use of the phrase creaturely logic. And I was looking at the live chat, and I saw some people, and I've seen some discussion afterward, and they thought that that was a bit snarky. So what was going on there?
Like, there's a lot of these different slogans in contemporary theology, like these like pithy sounding phrases that sound really powerful. They sound very pious, but they actually just prevent rational investigation. And a common slogan from a lot of Reformed theologians is that they object to creaturely logic and man's reason. Like, I'm only listening to God's wisdom, not man's wisdom. You see James White say this kind of stuff all the time. And so whenever I hear a phrase like creaturely logic, like that's nothing more than poisoning the well. And like what it does is it sets up this imbalance. It's basically saying you cannot critique me because you're using creaturely logic. Only I'm saying things that protect the godness of God. And I'm not saying that Gavin was poisoning the well intentionally. Like, I'm not saying that because I don't think he was. What I am saying, though, is he used a lot of these slogans that have permeated Calvinist theology. So Gavin had several of these kind of talking points in his opening statement that make it sound like there's like, this one like so-called ontological framework that's the royal road to truth. And if that came across as snarky, I'm sorry, but I just don't have patience for these slogans anymore, because it does prevent meaningful debate, and it makes it sound like only Aristotelian or Neoplatonic philosophy somehow magically transcends creaturely logic. So I decided at the very start, I need to have the audience understand that everything Gavin's saying is also creaturely logic. So let's just stop thinking in terms of these slogans and let's get to the real stuff.
So Ryan, right out of the gate, you asked Gavin why he kept bringing up Thomism. He kept saying that you were discussing or critiquing a Thomistic view of simplicity and stuff like that. And you said that, and he said that you're focused on Thomism, that's problematic. And then you asked him why he asked that question, or why he said that. So I'm curious just what was going on in your mind. Why did you really want to start the live debate with that particular question?
So I've complained to you guys both about this like in the past. So going back to 2011, like the second paper I ever got accepted for publication, it's called Divine Perfection and Creation, and it focuses on the Greek-speaking theologian John Philoponus and the Anselmian Catherine Rogers. And when I posted it online, all these Catholic blogs were attacking me, saying I'm misunderstanding Thomism. So a paper on Philoponus and Rogers is misunderstanding Aquinas. And I was just like, what is happening here? And then when the End of the Timeless God came out, the same thing kept happening. So I've got my modal collapse objection in that book, which is in a chapter on Catherine Rogers, and it's focused explicitly at the Anselmian Catherine Rogers. And people kept saying, you're just misunderstanding Aquinas. And I'm like, okay, I've come to two conclusions. Either you did not read me, or you lack basic reading comprehension skills. So like, what's going on? So what I've been doing since then is I have been intentionally not citing Aquinas as much as possible. I'm trying to just avoid citing him in my publications whenever I can, and then overemphasize and oversight everyone else. And I do this for several reasons, one of which is a test to see if my critics know how to read. So that way, when they accuse me of misunderstanding Aquinas, I could just say, either you didn't read my work or you just lack reading comprehension skills. And like I said earlier, I gave Gavin a forthcoming paper of mine on divine simplicity. And in that paper, the section where I articulate the doctrine of divine simplicity, I only mention Aquinas once in the text. I heavily focus on all the other thinkers throughout history and today that are the leading proponents of divine simplicity. And then in my opening statement, when I articulate divine simplicity, I did not mention Aquinas once. I mentioned all these other thinkers from across the world's religions and today who defend divine simplicity. So I did that so I could show, like, you know, you can articulate all this stuff without mentioning Aquinas. And so when Gavin said I was only focused on Thomism, I was like, did you actually read my paper? Is what I wanted to know. I was like, because if he'd read anything that I've written on the topic, he would know that I've interacted with a large array of thinkers, including a lot of Greek-speaking Christian thinkers. And so that's why I was like, why do you think I'm only focused on Thomism? Did you actually read what I sent you? And then when he said, like, well, you could have Thomism before Aquinas was born, I was just like, I'm sorry. Like, that just strains credulity. And I'm sorry if that sounds really harsh, but I just don't know what else to say, because I'm out here quoting Augustine and Anselm and Maximus Confessor, and I'm told, why are you critiquing, like, only Thomism? I'm like, I'm not. I don't know what to do here. So that's what was going on in my head. But let's get on to another topic here. So there was another phrase that kept coming up in this debate with Gavin, caricature. And this word came up a lot. So the claim was that I'm offering a caricature of the doctrine of divine simplicity, and apparently quoting people saying those things that they did in fact say is a caricature. So what did you guys think of this accusation? So Andrew, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I don't really think that what you were doing was a caricature at all. I mean, yeah, sure, there are several church fathers who don't cash out divine simplicity like the way that you defined it, or the way that Thomas or Anselm or Augustine defines it. That, yeah, I think that's somewhat trivially true. The Cappadocians, Palamists as well. But the fact that the view that you're describing, and this was Gavin himself said this at one point in the debate, that it seems to be even potentially the predominant view throughout Western church history. I think the fact that you do that, and that it's substantiated by many, if not most, of some of your top medieval scholars of theology and patristic scholars of Christian thought, I think that's kind of evidence that it's not a caricature. Okay, maybe there is some kind of sense where simplicity is a little bit broader than this particular definition, but it's a legitimate view that you're critiquing. It's not a caricature at all. So I can understand why Gavin might want to give a more deflationary definition of divine simplicity so as to account for more views, but I don't think that's helpful at all. And I found this to be a weird move, because he kept saying that what you were doing is a caricature. You had a more focused definition of simplicity than what he was offering, and he kept saying that's a caricature of the doctrine at large. Well, it seemed to me that he did sort of kind of the same thing with Samuel Clarke and the Trinity later on in the debate, because Samuel Clarke thought he was doing some kind of Trinitarian theology, as best as I understand Clarke. But then Gavin was quick to say, well, he really had a heterodox doctrine of the Trinity. It's not really the Trinity. And I'm like, well, you can't have this rule for people talking about simplicity and then throw that rule out the window when applying with people that we consider to be heterodox. I don't think it's a unidirectional rule. So I thought it was weird that he did that. And then I thought if that is what a caricature is, then I thought he was guilty of it himself later on in the debate. Maybe I've misunderstood Samuel Clarke, but at least I understood him he thought he was doing maybe some kind of Trinitarian theology.
Yeah. So Chad, what were you thinking?
Yeah, well, I think this goes back to the unfortunate fact that the discussion didn't begin with what was meant by simplicity. I think it could have turned out way differently, avoiding all the caricature business, had it started out with that. I mean, it could be that you have caricatured Gavin's view. I don't know what his view is. I don't know his work. But it could also be that you were not caricaturing any of the figures that you quoted. I have no reason to think that you were doing that. In fact, I think the figures you quoted were quite representative of the simplicity tradition.
Yeah, so I was just confused by this point, because, so like I said, so Gavin's published a paper on this in the International Journal of Systematic Theology, and in that paper he says there's the identity thesis, and then there's like the Cappadocian view, And what I pointed out to him before we did the debate, I was like, the main person you're relying on for this Cappadocian view, this claim that the Cappadocians thought that God has extra mentally distinct properties, is this guy named Andrew Radegalwitz, and he's changed his mind on the topic. So I told Gavin, I was like, just a heads up, Galwitz has changed his view. And so what Galwitz says is the predominant view is the view that he now affirms, which is this. The Cappadocians do not affirm extra mentally distinct attributes in God. So what they actually have is just the identity thesis. And so Gavin, I mean, he understands the identity thesis because he articulates it very well in that paper. And I'm like, well, that's what I'm critiquing. And the Cappadocians don't actually have this alternative view. So, you know, so yeah, I was at a loss for words. And then when we were, and there was this moment of the debate that really tickled me. So I was like, is it a caricature to cite these medieval scholars saying these things? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, what about Jeff Brouwer? Like when Jeff Brouwer says divine simplicity excludes all properties, all forms, all immanent universals, all tropes, any exemplifiables of any sort. When Jeff Brouwer says that in his own defense of simplicity, is that a caricature? And Gavin was like, yeah. And I was like, I'm just lost my grasp on what the word caricature means at this point. But, you know, or maybe I'm just being snarky again. But, you know, but that maybe that's also me just living in Philly because I've just become more snarky since living here. But let's get on to the next topic. So there was another major point of contention. So Gavin said there's all these different versions of divine simplicity throughout history. And so I wanted to get your guys' take on this. So, Chad, let me start with you.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. But over time, it was Thomas's view of simplicity that prevailed and became the standard version. I don't see how anyone could disagree with that. So even if he did come out of the gate swinging against Thomas's view, I don't think that would have been a problem.
Yeah, I agree with Chad on that. Obviously, there's a lot of people claiming to affirm simplicity, and then some of them do cash it out in different terms than Augustine, Anselm, Avicenna, Thomas, and so many others, because, it is the predominant view. But I really think this just comes back to what Chad was saying earlier. Until we agree upon a stipulated definition of simplicity, then what we do with these claims to affirm simplicity and how they're cashed out and stuff and whether or not their contents differ from one another, it's really not clear what we do with that. I think it's dubious what we do with that until, at least for the sake of debate, it's at least agreed on and stipulated what view you're talking about. So. But I think it's obviously true that what Chad said, there are people throughout the tradition claiming simplicity and then defining it in a way that's very different than that predominant stream. So I've got a question, and it is related to this point, actually. On your opening statement, you talked a lot about Jewish and Islamic thinkers who affirmed the doctrine of divine simplicity or who had something to say about the doctrine of divine simplicity. You seem to think that their historical contributions to this debate in Western history, they're actually very important. I've seen a lot of people online, for example, who are very confused, and they have no idea. Why do you keep bringing up Jewish thinkers, Islamic thinkers, and even some Hindu thinkers you've brought up into these discussions before? They don't see the point in that. Like, we only care what Christian thinkers get, I guess, because only Christian thinkers can get at truth. I'm not sure why, what the concern is there. But I see this a lot online. And clearly you have reflected on their contributions. Can you just explain to us why you think it's important for us to mention these Jewish and Islamic thinkers on divine simplicity?
I think a lot of people, when they're watching the live debate, they forgot what I did in the opening statement. Because in the opening statement, I said I want to consider a very particular claim that I see from a lot of people like David Bentley Hart, W. Matthews Grant, and many others. So the very common claim is that the majority of theists throughout history and across the world's religions affirmed divine simplicity. And I said, that's the claim I want to critique. And in case you're wondering, like Jews, Muslims, and Hindus from across the world's religions, they fall in the category of theists, you know. So I'm like, I want to look at what, you know, this claim that all theists say this stuff. And so I pointed out, well, it's just false that all theists affirm divine simplicity. And so trying to read any more into that, like psychoanalyze me, I'm just like, that's just weird. Now, there's another reason to focus on Jewish and Muslim thinkers. Like, if you want to know what I think is a very clear, a very early, and a very consistent meaning of the doctrine of divine simplicity in Western history, you have to look at these debates across the Abrahamic faiths and how they developed. Because, so for example, Aquinas cites Maimonides and Avicenna. We know that their understanding of divine simplicity greatly influenced Aquinas. So in order to do good scholarship, you have to look at what's going on in those other religions. And Christians do this all the time. Like, your standard like articulation of divine simplicity in Christian thought is they'll like be like, oh, what did Plotinus say on this? We want to get his understanding of what that looked like in late antiquity so we can figure out the impact he had on subsequent thinkers. I'm like, yeah, you just do the same thing to all the other thinkers. And then there's this other issue, though. This is very important. I really want to call into question the contemporary claim of so-called other versions of divine simplicity. Because what I pointed out in the debate is, going back at least to the 8th century, Muslim theologians have openly rejected divine simplicity. And those thinkers said God does not have parts, and they said divine simplicity is false. And so divine simplicity in their mind, very, very early on, does not merely mean the claim that God does not have parts. And this is a historical reality. I mean, the Kalam theologians say God does not have parts, God is not a composite, and divine simplicity is false. So you've got this very clear and very early meaning of divine simplicity that's agreed upon in the West, and is being debated about whether or not it's true. And all of this well before like Palamas or Aquinas are born. And then when I'm talking to like some of my different Muslim friends or scholars, and they hear these Christians say different versions of divine simplicity, they often ask, well, do these Christian scholars not know basic history? And I'm like, ooh, that's kind of embarrassing. Let me show that I can actually do that. And then finally, this is really important too. So here's what I see it. So if we take Gavin's claim that there's these other versions of divine simplicity, you have to explain what's going on in history, and you have to explain what's going on today. So here's what you'd have to do. First, you have to tell all the Kalam theologians like that they really do believe divine simplicity. So you have to tell all those Islamic theologians throughout history and today that even though you explicitly reject divine simplicity, you actually affirm it. And then you also have to look at the case of Thomas Aquinas and Peter of Tarentaise, like when they, in their earlier work, when they said God has extramentally distinct attributes, they get in trouble with the Catholic authorities. If there's these different versions of divine simplicity, why did they get in trouble? And then when you come to the Scotus case, you have to do the same thing. Why was Scotus accused in his own day of denying divine simplicity when he said, well, but I affirm it. If there's these other versions, why couldn't he just say, oh, well, I just affirm a different version? And then what you also have to do, finally, is you have to go up to William Lane Craig, and you have to go up to Stephen Davis and all these other contemporary critics. You have to go up to their face and say, guys, I know you just spent the last 30 years critiquing divine simplicity and saying it's false, but really, you're just a bunch of closeted divine simplicitists. Like, that's what you have to do. And since I don't think most people are going to be willing to do that, I want to say I don't think I can take this claim very seriously. So Chad, I've got a question for you now, though. So I want to talk about the doctrine of no real relations, because this is something that came up in the debate. So do classical theists actually say that God is not really related to the universe? And then what do they mean by that?
They do say that. Yeah, that's my understanding. But and I think you probably know more about this than I do. But and there's sort of a long answer and a short answer. The long answer gets into the technical Aristotelian Thomistic metaphysics of relations. But the short answer is just that God isn't really related to anything, including the universe and creation, because relations are, in Aristotelian categories, they're accidents. And God has no accidents. It's as simple as that. So do you want to just stick with the short answer? Or do you want
Let's
to
do the long answer, too. Yeah, give me some more details here.
Yeah, so for Aquinas, there are three kinds of relations. Real relations, conceptual relations, or relations of reason, and then there are sort of mixtures of both. And so a classic example of a real relation is one where the relation is grounded in some real quality of the substances themselves. So if Gavin is heavier than Ryan, I think I'm probably heavier than him, is my guess. So switch it again. So if Ryan is heavier than Gavin, that's because Ryan has more mass than Gavin. Okay, so there's a real fact about Ryan's mass and Gavin's mass that makes it true that Ryan is heavier, okay? For that not to be true, something about Gavin and Ryan has to be different, has to change. So that's a real relation. And then there are relations of reason or conceptual relations. And a good example here, which Thomas gives, is the relation of species to genus. Now, these are categories, species and genus. These are not real substances. These categories are just like abstractions of reason. And the same would apply to Cambridge relations, like to the left of. So these relations, you can kind of think of these relations as sort of being only in our minds. You know, they're just abstractions. And then finally, there are mixed relations where there's part real and then part conceptual. So a good example here would be knowledge or knowing. There's a relation between a knower and the thing known. Okay, there's an apple on my table, for example. Something changes in me when I know there's an apple on the table. But nothing about the apple changes. So it's a one-way relation there, with that only really affects me, not the apple. So it's kind of a mixed relation, part real, part conceptual. So when it comes to the universe or creation, for Aquinas, creation must be a mixed relation, because were it not for God, a massive change, something massively different would be true of creation, namely it wouldn't exist, but there wouldn't be anything different about God. God is the same regardless, with or without creation. Otherwise, something real about God would have changed, but God is changeless. So there's a real relation for us, but not for God. So here's how Gavin Kerr puts it in his book on Aquinas and the metaphysics of creation. He says, the relation of creation is nothing real in God, in which case it is a relation of reason. Hence, God is not really related to creatures through being their creator. Okay, now, what people like you and I find odd about this is that it kind of puts, if you accept this, it puts Thomas in the awkward position of saying that God isn't really creator, or any other relation for that matter. We are really created by God, but God isn't really creator. We are really saved by God, but God isn't really savior, and so on. So that, I mean, that strikes me at least as being preposterous.
Yeah, I guess I have the same issue here, because so like in the End of the Timeless God, I give 10 pages of exegesis on this, trying to trace out through Augustine and Boethius and Lombard and Aquinas and Scotus on this point, because I really want people to understand, like, this is what's really being said, and this is really weird. Like, Augustine's very explicit that he's worried about the relationship title of creator and Lord, and he says, we can say that God is the creator, but really we have to keep in mind that we're not pointing out any accidental or essential feature in God at all. It's just in our mind.
Well, they would say it's analogical.
Well, Augustine doesn't say it's analogical. He just says...
Or Thomas does.
No, not with those. So this is something weird. When you look at... So Thomas M. Ward, like the medieval scholar, does a lot of Scotus work on it. So his paper on the no real relations doctrine, he's going through, like, Aquinas says, like, literally no real relation because Aquinas says very explicitly, let me get the quote here really quick. So this is from Summa Contra Gentiles 2, 13 through 14. The relations are, quote, not really in him and yet are predicated of him. It remains that they are ascribed to him according only to our way of understanding. So it's just in your head.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what Thomas Ward points out is there's an inconsistency in Aquinas' thought, because the relationship between knower and known and cause and effect are the classic examples of a real relation. And Aquinas says, mm-hmm. yeah, God knows the universe and God caused the universe. And so Thomas is like, well, hang on a second. Like, those are real relations. So what do we do? And so Ward does this weird thing that he says, it's super controversial. A lot of people are not going to like it. But let's play around with Aquinas's doctrine of analogy here. So Aquinas says, like, God's like, it's literally the case. God's not really related to the universe. And Ward says, maybe what we can do is fix it and say, God's like analogically related to the world, because he has to have the property of causing the universe, and he has to have the property of knowing it. So maybe we can do some analogical footwork there. And I'm just like, I don't know what that means, but cool story, bro. But that's, again, like, this is like, you know, a medieval scholar saying, like, you know, these are all literal statements. And we've got these kind of problems here. But yeah, that's the doctrine there.
So on this point, Ryan, I have this unfortunate habit of being on the internet, and I couldn't help but notice that there are a lot of people who keep criticizing you for ignoring these classical theists out there who don't affirm this doctrine of no real relations. Just curious, do you ever argue with classical theists who reject the doctrine of no real relations?
Yeah, so I've got a whole chapter on it in The End of the Timeless God. So when people are saying this, it just demonstrates once again that either they're not reading me or they lack basic reading comprehension skills. So Kate Rogers, she's been very clear that she thinks the doctrine of no real relations is implausible. She thinks that the Augustinian Thomistic doctrine of no real relations, she thinks it just violates basic Christian doctrine. She's like, if God loves you, if God's sustaining you in existence, all these things, she's like, that's got to be a real relation. End of story. And she says Anselm never once mentions this doctrine of no real relations. And I think that's right. I've looked through not everything Anselm's read because I'm not like that obsessed with Anselm, but I don't find that no real relations doctrine in him. So what I've done in The End of the Timeless God and a lot of other papers is I look very explicitly at Anselm and Rogers and give my various critiques. So yeah, I know there's classical theists who say no real relations, that's weird, I don't like it. And I'm like, yeah, here's some arguments against you too.
Yeah, on that, would you say that for anyone who does affirm that there are real relations, loving, creating, savior, so forth, do you have to acknowledge then that there are accidents and gone? And if you do that, well, then that's going to be a major piece of the Thomistic infrastructure that falls.
And that's the problem. So that's why Kate Rogers tries to make some different moves. Because if God comes to acquire the property of creator, well, that's going to be a change.
Yeah.
And so she's like, well, it's all right. I've got this eternalist ontology of time. Such that God and the universe are co-eternal. They never exist without each other. So God does not come to acquire this property of being creator. I think there's other problems there, like in the neighborhood, but that's the whole point, though, is she makes these moves to try to accommodate the exact problem that you pointed out. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. It still doesn't help you. And I lay out reasons why. But yeah, that's exactly right. You just get a different set of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so there was something else, though, that came up in the debate, and I didn't get to discuss it at all, like, adequately, because we, only have limited time. So he claims that, so Gavin claimed a few different times there's these different ontological frameworks, and I've talked about him in person with him on this point, too. So in his mind, as I'm understanding it correctly, I think, he says, like, modern philosophers have one ontological framework, and it's different from the ontological framework of the patristics and medievals. And so he thinks, like, you're just going to be talking past each other. They can't really, like, get in each other's heads. So I've got a couple questions for you guys. Is there really one ontological framework shared by the patristics and medievals? And is this one singular and totally uniform modern ontological framework, like, wildly different? And then does any of this have anything to do with the truth or coherence of divine simplicity? So, Chad, I'll start with you.
I would say, I'm no specialist in medieval philosophy or patristic philosophy, but I would be very skeptical of the claim that they share some sort of monolithic ontological framework. I would come to that study very, very, very skeptically. But if we do define simplicity as God lacking parts, let's just assume for the sake of argument that that was a common claim across different ontological frameworks. Then the truth of simplicity is just going to turn on what counts as a part. And that does vary across different ontological frameworks. So that it seems everything really depends on what counts as a part. It all comes down to what counts as a part. I could say more about that if you want, or we could move on.
We could say a little bit more about it, yeah.
Okay, so the definition given in the debate about what counts as a part was really thin and permissive, which, if I recall, it was basically just the standard definition of proper part in extensional muriology. X is a proper part of some whole, W, just in case X is a part of W and is not identical to W. It's the not identical part that matters. Now, I'm not identical to God. That doesn't make me a part of God. It's got to be within God or internal to God or whatever. But on this view, anything, you pointed this out in the debate, Ryan, anything could count as a part, including attributes, properties, relations, universals, tropes, forms, it doesn't matter. So that's a very, very permissive view of what counts as a part. That's too broad and permissive in one sense, but kind of too restrictive in another. What's true about it is that not just material things can have parts. And I think that's a common misunderstanding about parts, is that only material things can have parts. There can be metaphysical parts, and even temporal parts. Immaterial things can have parts, and immaterial things can be parts. So just to take a quick example, the sides of a triangle, I think, plausibly count as parts of a triangle, or the variables in an equation plausibly count as parts of the equation, but these are immaterial things. Plato thought souls have parts, you know, the three parts, the appetitus, bearded, and rational parts. So immaterial things can have parts. Another common misunderstanding about parts is that whatever has parts is contingent and is assembled by something prior, or there's a unifier or unifying agent. But I just gave an example, a counterexample to that. A triangle, if it exists at all, it's a necessarily existent thing that's not assembled from three separate sides. It's just it's just there. It's the nature of a triangle to just kind of be there all at once. It necessarily and essentially has three sides, no assembly required. So immaterial things can have parts, and having parts does not imply being contingent or having been assembled or possibly falling apart. But the more you get into the nature of parts from there, we are constructing a broader ontological framework that does have implications about whether God has parts, and so it can be simple or not.
Yeah, so on this, I just think this claim that they had a different ontological framework than us, I just think that's trivially true. So, and here's why I think that's trivially true. I think Augustine was probably working with a fairly different ontological framework than was Lombard, Thomas, Henry of Ghent, and a lot of the medievals who preferred an Aristotelian ontological or metaphysical framework over and above a Platonic or Neoplatonic one. But that doesn't prevent them at all whatsoever from, A, appropriating Augustine's view, and they don't overhaul it to make it conform to theirs. They have no problem at many times just saying, hey, yeah, what Augustine says here is right. Let's just take that and run with it. If we can make that work with our framework, that's debatable, but they tried to. Also, it didn't prevent them from critiquing the ever-living crap out of other views that shared a more Platonic or Neoplatonic view. So just because they operated a different ontological framework didn't prevent, you know, critical dialogue between the frameworks. And I find it just kind of dubious to say, oh, well, we can't critique, in order to critique theirs, we have to critique it from within the framework. I'm like, well, that's just not obviously true to me. We don't do that today with different ontological, like, for example, you know, I tend to be something more like a metaphysical realist. I don't let that prevent me from critiquing people who are metaphysical anti-realists. That just doesn't prevent me from having the dialogue and critiquing them on issues that, hey, this makes more sense in this framework. But yeah, that just doesn't prevent that. So on this, different frameworks didn't prevent the patristic medievals from debating with one another on these points. And what I want to, let me back up a second and just say this. Even if we do have a different ontological framework, what I'm getting at is this.
Yeah.
So what? Like, so what if we do have a different one? It didn't prevent the patristics and medievals from debating with one another on these points, and it's not clear that it should prevent us today from also so doing. Also, even if there was this more unified ontological framework, it's still not clear to me that we should assume that framework or privilege it in these discussions. Okay, so our favorite thinkers of the past held to this ontological framework. That's how they cast these doctrines out. But we might have some really good reasons today for thinking, hey, there's a lot of problems with that framework, and that might be a result of why they have these problematic views of simplicity and much like this. So, I don't know, maybe more work needs to be done to show, hey, that framework just isn't helpful. Or but again,
yeah,
so what? Like, I guess I just don't see the point. If we have these different frameworks, I just don't get the big deal that's supposed to create for us. Sometimes I think there are people that I think there's a good motivation behind this. We want to understand these historical figures on their own terms, but I don't think that means we have to abandon our own frames of reference in order to do so. There can be a, as the hermeneutic philosopher Hans-Georg Gadamer would say, there can be a true and genuine fusion of the horizons of this framework with this one that allows for an actual meaningful and critical dialogue. And if we don't think that's possible, then I don't know. What's the point of even reading the past thinkers to begin with? Because we're not going to be able to do anything meaningful right. with them anyway.
Yeah. No, so.
Fusions of horizons. Yeah. I like that. Yeah,
there you go.
Going there.
Dude, you should read some Gadamer. He's some good stuff. He says all kinds of sexy stuff.
So, It's like, I really like what you're saying here, because so Kate Rogers, she pointed this out a long time ago too, when, because there was this stuff that came up saying like, oh, it's a relational versus constituent ontology. That's why, like, you know, no one can understand simplicity the right way. And she goes, what are you talking about? When you're looking at the history of Western philosophical theology, you see both of those views being debated throughout history. And in the, like, the master's program I teach at Lucerne, like, one of the things, like, that the students, some of them don't like that we have to go this deep into it, but we look very deeply at the influence of Neoplatonic and Aristotelian thinking in all the Abrahamic faiths, and how those all of those different views, like philosophical systems, impacted religious thinking. So it's just false that there's this one monolithic view throughout history. And then it's also false that it has anything to do with whether or not simplicity is true, because what you've got in the past are people who say simplicity is false, and I'm a Neoplatonist, or I'm an Aristotelian. And you've got people today who affirming all sorts of wildly different ontological frameworks and saying, yeah, simplicity true, or no simplicity at all.
Right. And I think one thing, too, just to add on to this, this wasn't in my notes, but, you know, Drew Johnson's written a very helpful book on this idea of a biblical Hebraic philosophy. I think it's quite clear that the ancient Jewish thinkers who wrote the Old Testament and those first Christians, they're not working with the same ontological framework that so many of these Neoplatonists and Platonists and Aristotelians are working with. So even then, the way they're trying to take something from this other ontological framework and fit it into theirs, I don't see how that's just any different than what we're doing when we're looking back and critiquing or appropriating theirs. So just to further confirm.
Now, Andrew, we can't say the Bible's philosophy, because then I'm not allowed to force my philosophical framework onto the Bible. So this is we'll get into the Bible later. Let's talk about the Trinity for a second. So one of the issues that came up was the monarchy of the Father in the Trinity. And so the claim is the Father causes the Son to exist. And so Gavin said, well, he was kind of struck by that. Like, he's like, that's kind of weird, and I don't know why anyone would say that. So, Andrew, let me start with you. Like, what did you think about that moment of the debate?
I thought a lot about that moment of the debate. So a few things. One, and here's why I thought a lot about it. Let me preface with why I thought a lot about it. One thing Gavin emphasized throughout his side of the debate, and I want to emphasize, I think he's right to emphasize this. He was emphasizing that when we read these past thinkers, and part of this is being sensitive to their different ontological frameworks and such, we want to read them carefully. We want to read them cautiously and generously. We want to give them a fair hearing. And so we need to read them very closely. Having said that, I don't know how you can read the patristic and medieval thinkers on the doctrine of God and miss that there is this widespread, it's almost as ubiquitous as divine simplicity, that the Father causes the being as the Son. We want to talk about ubiquitous claims. I've written several papers on this. I have a whole Word document of compilation of quotations of where the Cappadocians in particular use the Greek verb, you know, that they describe the Father as the aetia, the cause of the Son and the Spirit. Well, of course, this quickly makes people say, oh, yeah, well, they're probably thinking in this broad Aristotelian four causes set. And I'm like, ah, you're right. They are. That's why they give examples. When they describe the Father as the cause of the Son, they give a lot of examples, how a fire causes its heat, how a sun causes its light. In many examples like this, there's always this idea of the causes producing the effect. It's an efficient cause. And this goes back even as earlier, you know, Kevin Giles claims he finds it in Origen. Now, I can't find the quotation in Origen where that's at. I've tried to find that. But I'll give Kevin Giles some, I'll interpret him graciously and say, hey, it's there. Maybe I'm just missing it. But arguably, it goes all the way back to Origen in the second, early third century. Well, here's the thing. So we don't, even though they don't use the explicit language of efficient cause, I think the examples the patristics give us show us, hey, it is efficient cause, because it's all these examples of where the cause is producing the effect. Now, fast forward, and that same language, aetia, is kept by Damascene. Fast forward into the medieval period. Anselm is quite comfortable using both, I don't know how to pronounce Latin well, principia, wherever the word for principle is, and he's fine using the Latin causa. Uses them both to describe how the Father causes the being of the Son, uses the same analogies as a fire produces its heat, so forth. Then we get to Thomas, or actually before Thomas, we have Bonaventure. Well, Let me focus on Thomas first. The person who does, the one figure who I found who doesn't like this causal language, maybe there's more, but the one that I've found is Thomas. He's the main one who wants to say, no, we can say the Father's the principle of the Son, but we don't want to say he's the cause of the Son. And he gives these subordinationist worries as to what happens if we call the Father the cause of the Son. But that doesn't stop anyone else, because then we've got Bonaventure comes along. And it's been a few months since I read Bonaventure on this. Bonaventure says they after Thomas, everybody else says, no, it's clearly a cause. And they clearly understand it as an efficient cause because they don't question that. What becomes the debate beginning with Bonaventure forward is, yes, efficient cause plus some other kind of cause. So like Bonaventure, no problem with it being an efficient cause of the Son. The Father produces the Son. But, and I get this, it's one of these two. He wants to affirm also that the Father is the material and the final cause of the Son, or it's the formal and final cause of the Son, in addition to it being the efficient. But then Henry of Ghent comes along and says, no, you've got it wrong. He is the efficient, he is the formal and the material, but not the final. And then Scotus comes along and says, no, it's an efficient and two different kinds of formal cause. And then you've got Occam coming along and who knows what that guy says? And if you want to, and if people are concerned about this, J.T. Pash or Paash, I don't know how you say his book. He's got this really great book on medieval Trinitarian theology and how this concept of production plays out. But in case it's still not clear, I'm still not convinced. In addition to calling them efficient causes, the medievals are quite at home using this Latin word producere, I think is how you said it's pronounced.
Yeah,
the Italian.
With all the Italians.
pronunciation, Ryan.
Yeah,
with all the producere in English. But this idea of, no, the Father produces the Son. Now, they mean this in a way that the Son doesn't begin to exist, because they all agree, hey, he timelessly does it. There's never a moment where the Son begins to exist. That makes him eternal and fully equal with the Father. So we see here, actually, there's a linchpin that making the Son equal with the Father, eternity plays a role in that. You can be causally subsequent the Father, but still fully equal with the Father. And I think that's why, talked about Samuel Clarke earlier, that's why he found some of those claims a little dubious in some of his work. But whether or not Clarke is right on that, the point, though, is that Clarke is in a good standing with a whole tradition of, yeah, even Palamas on the Eastern tradition, yeah, the Father is the aetia of the Son and the Spirit, both of them, since, you know, the Son plays no role in that. So when I hear Gavin say, yeah, I don't know anyone that would say that or why anyone would say that, I'm really struck, because he just gave us a really good lecture on why we should read these people closely. And I'm thinking, it's difficult for me to want to see you doing that on these views, but then you don't have to read them closely, because the language of cause and of production, it's all over. Cause is all over the patristics. Cause and production is just all over the medievals. I know I've been going on and on this, but yeah, that just really struck me. I thought, really? You don't know anyone who would say that?
Kind of like an icing creed?
Maybe I'm being ungenerous there. I don't mean to, but I was just really struck by that. Of all the people in contemporary evangelical theology talking about the doctrine of God, Gavin's one that I would expect of, yeah, it's there. And again, for other people who want to read more on that, there's half the chapters in the Oxford Handbook of on the Trinity discuss this. Russell Friedman has a great book on medieval Trinitarian thought and how they understand this production, this cause idea. I mentioned Pasha's book, and Kevin Giles's helpful history with on eternal generation with IVP. It's helpful and points all of that out. And Stephen Holmes in his The Quest of the Trinity, he brings this point up. So it's really there. So I was just really struck by that. So I'm going to get off my soapbox now. I don't really know what that does with the monarchy of the Trinity, but I was just so struck by that idea. I don't know who would say that. I'm like, I know a lot of people who would say that.
Yeah. So Chad, what were you thinking on this?
No, I think Andrew's definitely the expert here, but I think Gavin is right to bristle at the suggestion that the Father causes the Son. But that just sounds shocking to a lot of people today, because we tend to think of causation as a temporal relation of production, where if something is caused, it has a beginning of its existence in time. That's just not what they meant back then. So if you just add that qualification, there doesn't seem to be a problem.
Right. And And I do have a paper on that to affirm what Chad says, that even though they want to make it a timeless cause, so there's no beginning to the existence of the cause, they do mean that. I have a paper where I actually investigate, hey, so their theory of causation, when we talk about causation in metaphysics today, what view of causation does their view seem to best work with? It's a powers causation. Like, it's not even close comparing it to, like, you know, just occurrence views or counterfactual views. It's not even close to it. Like, it's clearly
like a powers and production,
a powers view.
So basically what you're saying they're using causation in a way that we in the modern world cannot possibly understand in any way, shape or form.
if we believe that effects have to come temporally succeed a cause, then I would say, we can't understand that. But I think there's some philosophers out there who would say at least simultaneous causation is.
That's simultaneity is still a temporal relation, though.
Yeah, it is still a temporal relation. I agree with that. But what we see, though, is in the patristics, they love to take that simultaneity because they do this. They take, hey, in the same way that the Son is never without its light, so the Father is never without his Son. And they try to take that simultaneous temporal relation and make some kind of a leap to what an atemporal relation would be like. Now, I think such a leap is a little dubious, but I think that says more about the plausibility of an atemporal God and atemporal causal relations than it does anything else.
So I want to get into a different topic here. So one of the things that we did not get to talk about is the arguments that I gave Gavin when I tried to steel man his opening statement. So the claim is that if divine simplicity is false, then God has parts and is somehow dependent on those parts in like some super bad way. And whatever the super bad way is, it somehow undermines God's aseity. So Chad, you've been thinking about this a lot, so I want to get some of your thoughts on this. So what exactly is the problem here, or is there even a problem here?
Yeah, so when the debate opened with that, and you gave these three dependence arguments as his steel man arguments, I got really excited because this is what my work has been in for a long time, and I was like, "Oh man, we're finally going to get into the meat of the issue." What I think is the meat of the issue. So I was disappointed to see those arguments not really come up again in the rest of the debate. So what's going on here? What's the problem? I think the fundamental problem is that it's assumed that dependence, just as such, dependence implies imperfection. So because things with parts ontologically depend on their parts, things with parts can't be perfect. So if God has parts, God depends on his parts, he's a dependent being, and so he can't be a perfect being. That's the main problem. Only an absolutely independent being can be perfect. And we see throughout the literature here, absolute independence, this attribute of independence, is often just simply identified with God's aseity, which is a divine perfection. So, and I think there's a strong argument for this. There's a cosmological style argument. You look around the world, you see things that are dependent. They are dependent on other things. But this chain of dependent things can't stretch back to infinity for all the philosophical arguments you can get for that. So it needs to terminate in a being that is independent, and this being is God. Now, this kind of argument has a long and venerable history. I think you find it most prominently in Aquinas' Third Way, but I think the strongest presentation of this style of argument is in Samuel Clarke. Samuel Clarke's been making a lot of appearances in this. He's great. But I think there's something right and wrong about this dependent style argument. So let's start with what's right about it. And that's that there are some kinds of dependence relations that are incompatible with perfection. So again, let's look out around at dependent things and see that some things depend on other things for their being. And this kind of dependence is asymmetric and it's external. So if A depends on B but not vice versa, and A and B are entirely or wholly distinct, they're separate ontological beings. And this is how we're able to trace the chain of dependence. So not only is it asymmetric, it's also transitive. So we can hop from one dependent being to the next until we finally reach an independent being. So that's our cosmological argument for God.
Yeah.
So I think we can say that when A asymmetrically depends on B, and they're wholly distinct, they're totally separate from each other, ontologically speaking, B is ontologically greater than A. I think that's a fair point. The problem is, there are more kinds of dependence relations than just this, right? Not all dependence relations are like this.
Right.
If you have a being that depends on its parts, and its parts depend on each other, and this being, by the way, depends on nothing else outside itself, there's no problem. There's no problem. So the parts are not external to it, so it doesn't depend on anything outside or external to itself. And if the parts equally depend on each other, then none is ontologically greater than the other. It seems like we've solved the problem. There's nothing to worry about here. And it seems like this is exactly what we should say when it comes to the case of the Trinity. It's important to understand, though, that all models of the Trinity require dependence relations between the persons. All of them do.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't just be that dependence in itself is incompatible with perfection. If that were the case, then all models of the Trinity are kaput.
Right.
So it seems like so let's think about the doctrine of eternal generation for a second, the monarchy of the Father, where the Father generates the Son. It's eternal generation, however you want to cash that out. That does seem to require the kind of dependence relation incompatible with the perfection because it's asymmetric. The Father generates a Son, not vice versa. And the Father is the external source of the Son, right? So that does seem to involve the problematic kind of dependence relation that people decry when they want to uphold the attribute of aseity. So I think we should say is that the persons of the Trinity equally or mutually depend on each other. So there's no question of ontological superiority between the persons. I think that's the way we should go.
If I can just add to that real quick, and to agree with what Chad was saying, is that even all the way back in Athanasius, you know, Athanasius has some kind of proto version of it. See, in the medievals, there's this really big debate about what constitutes the person, what makes the person that person. And so you've got this more Franciscan-y tradition that says what makes the Father is that he generates the Son. And the Father, you know, logically subsequent, it's about logical priority. Logically prior to the Father's being the Father is the Father's generation of the Son. It's the generation of the Son that's logically prior to the Father's being the relation paternity. But going back as far as Athanasius, he sees a potential problem with this. He says, well, no. In order to be the Father, yes, he does generate the Son, but also if there is no Son, there is no Father. So he wants to emphasize there's a kind of reciprocity between these two on this point. But then we get to the medieval period, and this becomes the more Dominican relational view, or there was some called the relations of opposition. What constitutes the Father as the Father is the relations of opposition he has with the Son, who is the relation filiation. So to show you to break down what this all means, Franciscans say what makes the Father is that he generates the Son. So the generation of the Son logically prior to his being the Father. But then you have the Dominicans want to say, no, that seems to create a problem. He needs to always have been the Father. There's nothing logically prior, so he is the Father, and he generates the Son because he is the Father. And what also, and then added with that is the Son's really being the relation of filiation because paternity and filiation are opposed to one another. It's these relations of opposition that are logically prior and constituting the persons. So to Chad's point, yes, no matter how you want to cash it out, And it's well established throughout the history of the Trinity in patristic and in the medieval period. This is Russell Freeman's book on medieval Trinitarian theology really highlights these different views on what he calls the emanationist views and these relational views. So throughout it's a sticking point throughout Christian history. Hey, the persons in some way or another depend on one another to be the person that they are, but that doesn't seem to create a problem for aseity on that. So it's not. So to echo what Chad says, it's not clear to me why all of a sudden all dependence relations when it comes to the divine nature are magically bad all of a sudden.
So basically, for the audience's sake, everybody needs to encourage Andrew to finish writing his book on the processions, and then everybody needs to encourage Chad to finally write up this like all this stuff on the aseity and the Trinity that you've been thinking about for these years.
It's under review.
Because I've been annoyed. I'm like for a long time. I'm like, Chad, just get this out there because I need to figure this out in my own head. I can't do it. You do it. So I want to copy your homework. But let's get onto the Trinity a little bit more. I've got another question related to the Trinity. So like Chad, you mentioned like maybe we just say the persons are proper parts. But there's this common worry that if we say that divine persons are like these parts of God, we've landed in the heresy of partialism. So what is partialism? Is it a heresy? What is this?
Right. Well, you mentioned that it's been a while since I've been on your podcast, and the one time you had me on was when I actually gave an argument for thinking God has parts. think of the persons as parts. But yeah, let's talk about partialism. Is this a heresy? Partialism? Partialism is not an articulated or named heresy like modalism or Arianism. Partialism, as far as I can tell, comes from a YouTube video that gets shared every St. Patrick's Day. All right, can we just leave it at that?
Has partialism, Patrick?
All right. No, the best I can make of the charge of partialism is that each of the three persons is not a third of the Trinity in the sense that each isn't fully divine, but only a third divine, as if each needs to add up their divinity to get something fully divine. I agree that that's not true. That's ridiculous. Divinity is not additive like this. Mm-hmm. Divinity is not sort of a quantitative property mm-hmm. like weight is. It's more like a qualitative property. So like color. So if you have a brick wall, and each of the bricks is red, and each of the bricks weighs a pound, the wall is going to weigh more than a pound, but the wall is not going to be any more red because it has a bunch of red bricks, right? Okay. So in that sense, if that's what partialism is, I agree that that's a problem. But if it isn't, I'm not sure what partialism is. To say each person is the whole Godhead, well, that's clearly false, since each person is not identical to each other. There are three distinct persons. Everyone agrees with that. So no one person is the whole Trinity, but only part of the Trinity. What's the problem? I don't know what the problem is.
Right. So, and I know, for example, now I know people don't like his essay and his view, but, you know, Craig is taking this up, you know, and Cornelius Plantinga before him, they talk about there's more than one way to be divine. You know, you can be the Trinity as a whole, or you can be divine by having the divine nature. I think, I can't remember if it was Leftow, whoever it was, called that Plantingian Arianism. I'm not really sure what's Arian about that. That's very unclear to me what's Arian about there being more than one way to be divine. But I just think that's obviously true. You can, and Craig gives the classic example, you can be a cat by being a whole cat, or you can be feline by being a whole cat, or you can be feline by having a feline nature. So I don't know why saying that there's more than one way to be this thing, mm-hmm. in this case divine, it's not clear. Yeah. Well, it's a bad thing. It's a very unclear thing.
Yeah, because if you're going to get the Arian charge, it's not just there's more than one way to be divine. It's like there are lesser divine beings. Right. And some of those persons are lesser. Yeah, that's what you need.
You know, I think
maybe it has to do with my ontological framework.
I think part of the problem is, you know, once we have a label mm-hmm. for something, it gets really fun to just sort of dismiss all these views out there as being this or that. You know, this is Arianism, this is modalism, now I have a term for it, now this is partialism. It's like the classic example of the undergrad that learns the names for popular informal fallacies. All of a sudden, everything is an informal fallacy, right? Mm-hmm. He's got a name for all the informal fallacies. I think that's kind of what's going on with partialism. I was like, all right.
You mean kind of like how Samuel Clarke was accused of being a Socinian? Did I say it right, Ryan? Socinian?
Yeah, you said. Yeah, you did.
It's kind of like how he's accused of being a Socinian when he's not remotely a Socinian. Subordinationist, maybe. It's not clear at all that he's a Socinian.
If I ever write a book called In Defense of the Trinity, I hope everyone says, Ryan was explicitly denying the Trinity when he was trying to defend the Trinity. Anyway, let me get on to the last question here. So I want to talk about the Bible. So one of the claims Gavin makes in his opening statement and then the debate we did was that we need simplicity in order to maintain a biblical view of God. And then he refers to 1 John where it says God is love. And I can name all these classical theists like Louis Burkhoff who scoff at the notion that you're going to get simplicity out of that verse. But I'm just kind of curious what you guys think. So like Andrew, let me start with you.
I don't think it's the case that you get simplicity from any kind of verse in the Bible. I know there are some people who want to make this claim that, like, following Westminster, that it's what the Bible explicitly says and then what can be deduced from that. It's not clear to me simplicity is even, necessarily deducible from what the Bible gives. Again, as Chad's already shared with us, you can have parts and it not take away from being assay. You know, like for example, you can still enjoy aseity and be composite to some extent or another. Not that I believe that God's composite, but you get what I'm saying. It's not obvious it's a problem. But number two, I just have no idea what being love has to do with being simple. Because it seems like with love, I mean, this goes back to Augustine, right? And I know he's talking about the persons, not the divine nature. But then I don't know what to do with that when Augustine wants to say each of the persons is the divine nature, like in this identity sense. That you love, there is no love if you don't have a loving agent and a beloved. Like, you've got to have these parts, if you will. So it seems like if you're going to try and get simplicity from the Bible, saying that God is love isn't going to do that. So I'm really just kind of lost. Now, maybe I need to read more patristic and medieval biblical commentaries on this to see how they get that and see some of their reasoning. It's not remotely obvious to me how simplicity follows from saying that God is love.
So, Chad, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, I agree. I would be more diplomatic, I think, than Andrew by saying that I think the claim that divine simplicity is in the Bible, or even deduced or implied by anything in the Bible, is on par with saying Jesus turned water into grape juice or non-alcoholic wine. I think it's a transparent imposition of one's own personal views onto the text. And look, if you want to defend divine simplicity, fine. Let's hear your philosophical arguments. But let's not pretend that this relic of Neoplatonian Aristotelian metaphysics is in the Bible. I just can't respect that.
Yeah. And I mean, your average Old Testament scholar is going to say, like, yeah, this is just not, it's not here.
Right.
And then in this forthcoming debate book on divine simplicity that I'm taking part in, I've got all these different Jewish thinkers who explicitly say, like, yeah, simplicity and these other classical notions, it is a violent imposition on the biblical text. And I'm like, I don't know if I'd say violent, but that's their word. So I'm like, okay, I'll just quote you saying violent.
Metaphysical violence.
Yeah, it's a metaphysical violence. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thanks, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Ryan. It's a lot of pleasure.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on philosophical theology.